You're listening to part two of Falling Off the Glass Cliff, a two-part podcast series from producer and storyteller Karen Given. If you haven't listened to part one, you can find the episode by searching Global Sport Matters Podcast wherever you listen. And now, on to the show.
We've been talking about the concept of the glass cliff. In case you need a reminder, Dr. George Cunningham at Texas A&M defines the glass cliff as
the phenomenon where women and minoritized individuals, when they receive or obtain a leadership position, it's likely to be in a precarious position. And by that, they mean a organization or firm or team that's had a history of failure, that's in crisis.
Last week, we talked about how the glass cliff plays out in college football. And this week, we wanted to look at the NFL, where the Rooney Rule and public pressure has sometimes led to black head coaches being hired into situations that are far from ideal. I'm joined by Scott Brooks, Director of Research for the Global Sport Institute. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And by Yahoo Sports, Shalice Mansa-Young. Hello again, Shalice.
Hello.
So I know that I gathered y'all here to talk about the persistent lack of black head coaches in the NFL, and we're going to get to that. But I actually want to start in another sport altogether, and that's women's college basketball. When South Carolina beat UConn to take the national championship a few weeks ago, Dawn Staley became the first black head coach, male or female, to win two Division I basketball titles. And she wasn't at all shy when talking about what that meant.
Well, by God, if you give us opportunities, so our black women, our black men out there, your coaches, stick with it. Persevere, because our adversity is our advantage. Always know that and always lean in on that.
Coach Staley has been a huge advocate for black coaches, black journalists. Scott, can you talk a bit about what her advocacy has looked like?
Yeah, I can. Dawn, what she says her mission is to be a dream merchant for young people. And that starts because she's a woman from North Philly, right? She was just a girl from North Philly. She always played sports. It was her kind of avenue out of North Philly and the projects there. She goes off to Virginia. She has culture clash, but she just keeps on going through it. You know, I mean, she's the Naismith two-time player of the year, now Naismith two-time coach of the year. No other person has ever done these things. So basketball has really done a lot for her life. And in Philly, you know, that's what folks talk about. Any of the legends in Philly will talk about how much the game actually means to them, that the game is in itself. We talk about it as sociologists as being a social institution. We know in terms of being black folks in particular, sport has been this avenue for us. It means more to us than just this extracurricular activity. And so Don's advocacy is saying, I'm going to use this thing that I love, that has given me so much, that has allowed me to do, you know, more than I ever could have imagined. And in doing so, I know that I can solve some of these other problems that we face. And so her advocacy goes way back just in terms of this belief, this hope, and seeing it for herself. And even in her rejection of coaching early on, what she says is, if I had known and had had the vision that this is what I could be doing, I would have been there the whole time, because she's been this way about basketball and what it can do for others. And so then the other part is being a great point guard. She gives assist, right? And so her whole thing is, it's not just about me. I can be doing as well as I can, and yet if others are not coming up with me, then I don't feel like I've done anything. And that's the true mark of a champion. It's the true mark of a point guard, particularly in Philly. You know, Philly point guards are always have this toughness. They're always about leadership and pulling people with them. And Don just really, really embodies that. I have personal stories that, you know, if we want to talk a little bit more about Don, but that's, you know, that's what her advocacy is all about, more than just herself. It is about bringing the game of basketball, and in particular this women's game, advancing it, because she really believes in its power.
Well, and not just the game of basketball and the game of women's basketball, but, you know, she's into advancing the careers of other Black head coaches throughout the sport, throughout all sports. She's into advancing the careers of Black journalists. I mean, Shalise, when you look at these sorts of things that she speaks out about, what does that mean to you?
Well, I think it's, you know, as Scott said, one of the truly remarkable things is that she is, I know the losses eat at her, right? When you can't get to the level and the heights that she has risen to as a player and as a coach without the losses eating at you. But she has a podcast called Net Life. And after South Carolina lost the SEC title game to Kentucky, she went on there and she said, yes, we're frustrated, but you could tell she was genuinely excited because, you know, Kentucky women's basketball, not really a big time player on the national stage and has a Black female head coach. So she was as excited to see their success and that coach's success because she knows it's somebody else who hopefully now they can go back to their, you know, athletic director and say, look, you know, I'm having as much success as the men's team is. So, you know, my pay should be close to the men's coach. And this new thing that she's added with acknowledging Black sports journalists is tremendous because that's what we really need. My friend Howard Bryant, who is just so brilliant and has been a sports journalist for years and years and years, the one thing that he notes is that particularly in the big outlets, what we're seeing more and more now is that the Black journalist is not really, especially on the men's side, it's former athletes. They're not young men who, of course, you know, I was an athlete growing up and a lot of us were athletes to some extent. And then at some point we realized, okay, in my case, you're not going to be the next Jackie Joanna Kersee. What's the next best thing to do? So it was journalism. It was getting into the game to be around sports. And for her to see us and, you know, especially there's so few Black female journalists, sports journalists, it's so hard, especially on the writing side, we're seeing more in front of the camera and that's great. But that's not the only avenue, you know, being a sports writer, I've done both. I much prefer writing. I love telling stories in that way. I love being able to express myself in that way. And I think a lot often of, you know, especially lately of how many young Black women, they just weren't supported in the way that I was early on. And maybe having Dawn Staley shine a light on it helps. And that, you know, when I walk into a media workroom, I'm not the only person that looks like me. And one or two of us becomes four or five of us becomes eight or 10 of us because, you know, it's great. And it's really, it just is. She takes on so much and I'm sure it's a burden in some ways for her, but for her to be celebrating her people and really leaning into it, you know, she's not going to be cowed by, well, why do we have to talk about color all the time? Because it still matters, you know, because there's been deliberate exclusion for so long and she is going to force the issue and really highlight the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, Shalise, you talk all the time about how in order to become a head football coach in the NFL, a Black person has to be pretty much a unicorn. And mm-hmm. Dawn Staley absolutely is a unicorn. And one of the things that I think comes up when we talk about her success and what it means for other Black coaches out there is if she just is seen as too much of an outlier, like she's the exception. Do you worry about that when we talk about people like Dawn Staley?
I don't. I mean, let's be real. She coaches at the flagship University of South Carolina, which is, you know, has had its share of issues over the last few hundred years. And they sell out all the time. And granted, winning plays a huge role in that. But she is a unicorn. Would she be as beloved if they were struggling? Probably not. You know, if she was leaning into, you know, the Blackness and, you know, supporting Black people and then not doing as well results wise, it would probably be a completely different story. We all know that, unfortunately. But there's so much to be said for that representation. There was 18 years between Carolyn Peck winning at Purdue as the first Black woman to win a national championship in basketball And Dawn Staley winning her first one was South Carolina. And now she has two. So we just need, you need to see that. It just helps. It's not, obviously somebody had to be the first. You know, Carolyn didn't have somebody to look up to. She had to be the first, but it just helps. You know, as Dawn says, your national championship might not be the actual national championship, but it might be winning the conference as the coach at the University of Kentucky did. You know, that's a massive accomplishment. You know, for other coaches, these Black women who coach lower level D1 programs, maybe it's going over 500 in conference play one year because your school's never done that. So everyone has goals and accomplishments, and she just wants to be that, you know, North Star for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Scott, one of the things Dr. Fitzhill brought up last week is that he believes that when a Black head coach wins NCAA football championship, that we'll see a sea change in that sport. We certainly haven't seen it as a result of Dawn Staley's success. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that there are too many factors to take into account for that to be the case. It could happen, but it's going to be, you know, what else is going on in our society? What I make of it is society doesn't change because, you know, we talk about this gradualism. It's definitely not simply because 10 years have passed through things didn't change. We know that more than likely things kind of revert back in particular ways, right? So, you know, Michael Brown is murdered. You're talking about Trayvon Martin. And then you get to everything that happens in 2020. These things are, you know, it's a confluence of factors that come into play. One of them didn't just force anything. And yet you need these bursts. You need these critical moments that arrest everyone's attention, that then galvanize support and people saying, you know what, whatever we were doing before, I'm fed up with that. But then we get into the fatigue that we get after you've battled with going against the structure and institutionalization. How do we do it? And the frustration. So what we see, and you can look at this in the history of the NFL hiring of coaches of color, is you'll get bursts. You'll get 1 year of 5, 6, 7. We've had as many as 8 in one given year. And then you'll go back to the normal pattern of 1s, 2s, 3s, 3s, 2s, and oh, a 6, and then you're back down to 2s and 3. And so I don't think anything supports this notion that there's going to be one magical opening that happens because of that. Instead, I think it's going to have to be societal pushes. It's going to have to be these terrible moments and tragedies that make people have to think about things differently, pushes their willingness. And that's really more of what we see when we see longer term change.
I think it's also systemic, you know, with NFL, similar to NCAA. What percentage of NCAA athletic directors are Black or people of color or women? You know, in a lot of schools, you have to have somebody who's the head of women's sports, but that person often reports to the male athletic director. It's the same right. thing that the NCAA has. The person who is in charge of all of NCAA women's basketball reports to the man who's in charge of men's basketball. So until you have these sorts of changes where we see more athletic directors of color, not that it should be a Black person hiring a Black person, but you just need to have an entire structural change, because not as many athletic directors, these jobs are all tenuous, right? And so you have big money supporters, boosters, who are always putting pressure on you. We have to have this, we have to have that. And usually they're only focused on the men's sports, football, basketball, or whatever. But you have to take that risk and understand that, does this coach look different than every other coach we've had? Yes. Does that automatically mean they're going to be a failure? No. And chances are, if they're Black, and especially if they're a Black woman, they're the most experienced candidate you've ever had.
Absolutely. All right. So I want to move on to the NFL, which is the league that we all seem to pay the most attention to when it comes to the lack of opportunities for Black coaches. And I'm realized that I'm talking to two people who discussed this very thing less than 3 months ago. So I want to start by actually taking us back to that point where Mike Tomlin was the only Black head coach in the league and things were looking pretty grim. And Shalise, you wrote about the Houston Texans and their firing of David Culley. And that was definitely what I've been talking about the last few weeks, which is a glass cliff type of situation, a situation where a coach is put somewhere with the expectation that they're going to fail. So I'm hoping that you can remind us of what went down in Texas.
So the Houston Texans essentially hired David Culley to be a bridge. There was a lot of talk after the 2020 season that they wanted to hire Josh McCown as their head coach. For those who don't know, Josh McCown is a career journeyman quarterback. He is white. He has never coached anywhere ever. And they interviewed Josh McCown to be their head coach in 2020. Now, they hired David Culley. Given the roster that David Culley had to work with, the fact that they won four or five games is absolutely remarkable. And they also started to develop their quarterback. They drafted a quarterback last year in the third round. He actually looks like he could be maybe not a world beater, not Tom Brady, but, you know, certainly seems like he has the makings of a very serviceable NFL starting quarterback. Quarterback's coach in Houston last year was Pep Hamilton, who is a Black man who has never gotten a chance to be an NFL head coach. And he should. That's a side note. However, so David Culley was fired after 1 year, and he essentially seemed like when he was hired to begin with, people didn't understand where they got David Culley from. He had never, I don't even think, been a coordinator previously to the Texans hiring him. And then they made him the head coach. And it seemed at the time, because David Culley ended up being the only Black head coach hired early in 2021 for last season, that the Texans maybe had fallen on the sword with the NFL among their NFL ownership class. And they decided, you know, oh, well, we can go 0-7 in terms of hiring Black coaches. So you guys are the last ones to hire. You have to hire a Black coach. Maybe that's where David Culley came from. Fast forward a year, they fired David Culley. They again dragged their feet for some reason on their hiring, because as the grumblings go, they really did want to hire Josh McCown, but they were afraid that everyone would laugh at them, as we should, because they want to hire a head coach who's never been a coach before. But then again, because they dragged their feet, and the NFL now on February 1st is slapped with a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit from Brian Flores, alleging racial bias within the league, and specific to, at the time, the Denver Broncos and the New York Giants. Then all of a sudden, the Houston Texans decide to hire Lovie Smith as their new head coach, who is also a Black man. It's just all a mess. The Brian Flores lawsuit, it seems like the league is taking it seriously enough. Will it lead to change? I don't know. But it certainly, I believe, has put the ownership class on alert.
And now let me ask you this follow-up. Do you think Lovie Smith is going to be given any more opportunities to succeed than David Culley was? Is he going to be given, you know, the sort of support that he needs to make something happen there?
Well, Lovie Smith has been a head coach on two other occasions. So he at least has the experience. It was not an out of the blue sort of hire. He was on David Culley's staff last season. So he does have familiarity. They kept Pep Hamilton, who was the quarterback's coach last year, and now have made him offensive coordinator. So the pieces are in place. The problems specifically in Houston are kind of a lot bigger. We could literally be here all day, because essentially they have a man who is a team chaplain, kind of runs, has like a really outsized influence on what happens in Houston. And it's just bonkers that this is the situation. I mean, he was a team chaplain and character coach with the New England Patriots. The Houston Texans hired him a few years ago, and he essentially helps run the team. It's bonkers. It's bonkers. So there are far bigger problems in Houston than just who the head coach is.
Understood. Scott, this brings up something interesting, I think, which is whenever we look at a specific case study in the NFL, and there are only 32 a year, we run into like this, well, this is an exception and this is an exception. And that guy really deserved to be fired because of X, Y, and Z. So how can research help us figure out what the problem actually is and what exactly is going on out there?
Yeah, so, you know, the way that research delves into this is to try to go with what are all the proposed explanations, and let's, you know, either we can show right away that either you can hold on to those hypotheses, right, that there's support for it, or you reject them, or you have to play around in these cases where the numbers are so small with, well, okay, we can say what it isn't, right? We may not be able to tell you exactly what it is, but we can talk more about what it is, what it isn't. But the problem is these things are changing all the time. And so, you know, we have code words like fit, and fit encompasses, it's just so ambiguous. And it is also so subjective. Many of the things that Shalice points to, you know, all of those other factors about organizational culture and, you know, what other things are going on, all of those can play a role, right? Is this space conducive to a head coach of color? And these are the things that, you know, when you're looking at the Bucks, when you're looking at the Dolphins, you know, some of these have been, oh, that's the blackest organization in football, right? And part of the thought is, and it gets back to what Shalice was saying earlier about leadership positions. And so, you know, instead of talking about athletic directors and presidents, we're talking about general managers and owners. And so you look at the Dolphins and you say, Stephen Ross has created this RISE initiative. He's, you know, he responded, you know, right away to the whole kind of bullying, right? That's what kind of sparked what seems to be his activism. And now he's got a black general manager, right? So we're saying that all that makes him a blacker organization. Now, whether or not that actually holds is a whole nother story, but that's what people are kind of, we start to build in these things. So as a researcher, you say things like, what are things that we can see in the organizational culture that would either tip our hat to access discrimination, they don't bring anybody in, or treatment discrimination? And what we see is this treatment discrimination is going to highlight things like, are there opportunities for people in the trajectory, right, in the pipeline, you know, things like, do they hire somebody for a second chance? Do they give them extra kind of room to make decisions? And this is where it gets really kind of tricky, because when you bring in a woman, person of color, you end up with issues around the power that goes on inside the actual organization. So that treatment discrimination is everything. Coaches, when you get a job, are you comfortable, or are you even influenced explicitly with who you can bring in? So the whole Tomlin issue is, where is his pipeline? He's been there forever now, right? So he's got the longest tenure next to Belichick. Oh, he's close to that. He's had all this success. So theoretically, he should bring in everyone. And we can say, well, he doesn't have to bring in black folks. But see, the norm has been homology, right? So homologous kind of reproduction, that you're going to bring in people like you. So the fact he doesn't raises some flags. Like, what's going on here? Is this really a conducive culture? Or is there something about Tomlin? Tomlin says he would if he could, but the record doesn't show. I mean, so you just get all this ambiguity. So what I would tell you research is able to do is kind of tell you, if we can't give you a direct answer to rule out others, and what we know is structurally access, we clearly still have a problem. But deeper than that, when you're looking at the Rooney Rule, how it has been executed, the fact that the numbers are not persistent, you know that there's also issues going on inside. And that's what Brian Flores's lawsuit is all about. It's not just talking about whether or not you gave me a chance. It's now looking at the equality of the actual opportunity, and not just, you know, okay, you gave me a number of years and I won at the same rate. No, but what about the day-to-day stuff? How are you being influenced? How are you being pressured by these external stuff? And are you given the benefit of the doubt? Because that leads to imposter syndrome. It leads to just high blood pressure. I mean, all the things that affect us disproportionately anyway. It's going to cause a lot of problems. And then your performance will suffer because you're dealing with all these extra stressors. And so now it starts to muddy the water because you want to be able to measure performance, but you can't because it's not a level playing field, right? No matter what, we can go across these sports. If you just give people an opportunity, even if they're unicorns, if that environment is not conducive, they're going to end up fulfilling these stereotypes that we don't belong here. Like it, then it ends up feeding the structure and the systematic way. Because if these great coaches don't do well, if Lovie Smith doesn't do well, it'll be, well, he had one good time with Chicago, but after that, he hasn't really been good. So he probably wasn't good anyway. Those are the kinds of things we'll start to see. And research can tell us what's going on, but research is not used as well. These owners and general managers don't necessarily care about the research. They're making their decisions around fit and on these short-term kinds of, you know, angles and perspectives.
Yeah.
To build off of what Scott said, there is something I think to the idea that what is it like behind the scenes and how many of these owners and general managers, okay, fine, we'll hire a black head coach, but then what will the fan reaction be, or even their reaction be, if that black head coach names, let's say, two of his three coordinators are also black? And then are the fans like, oh my God, you know? Or again, could it be the owner or the GM or both who are like, oh my God, that's too black? You know, Mike Tomlin, he has completed 15 seasons as head coach of the Pittsburgh Steelers. This coming season is the first season where he will have a black coordinator. And that is something that he has been publicly criticized for by people like myself who are very invested in seeing, you know, the NFL stop its what seems to be deliberate exclusion of black coaches. Because, you know, Mike, it's nice to go on television shows and documentaries and whatever and hang your head about, oh, I wish it were different. Well, you're in a position to make it potentially different. And so this is the first year where he will have, and to his credit, he did hire Brian Flores. Brian Flores is going to be his linebackers coach and I believe special defensive assistant or something like that. You know, the reality is Brian Flores was not going to get a head coaching job this year once he brought that lawsuit. But the other thing that I think sort of bolsters my point about if you bring in a black head coach, whether explicitly or implicitly, they're told that their top level assistants cannot also be black, is that twice in the 103 seasons of the NFL have we seen a coaching staff with all three or even four, if you extend it out to assistant head coach, the top lieutenants be black. And it was both white head coaches. It was Bruce Arians when he took over in Tampa Bay a couple of years ago. All four of his top assistants, his assistant head coach, his special teams coordinator, his offense coordinator, defense coordinator, all black men. Last year in San Francisco, it kind of flew under the radar because most people weren't sure what the heck Mike McDaniel is. And most people assume that Mike McDaniel, who is now the head coach in Miami, was white. But Mike McDaniel, as he calls himself, is multiracial. The fact that he doesn't really call himself black is another podcast for another time. But Kyle Shanahan did have all three of his coordinators last season were non-white coordinators. But again, these are white coaches with a level of success also that they brought into the job that gave them probably the credibility to say, this is who my lieutenants are going to be, take it or leave it, you know, with ownership, with the team president, the GM, whoever it was. I will say relative to the Buccaneers, which is where Arians was, there are still, I think, 17 NFL teams who have never had one black head coach, and the Buccaneers are now on their fourth. So we at least have to give them credit for that. They did Lovie Smith dirty. That was where he had his second go round as a head coach. They fired Lovie Smith despite a 4-win improvement from season one to season two. They fired him to promote the man who was Lovie's offensive coordinator at the time. And that guy was a total disaster. So they did Lovie Smith dirty. But, you know, in the last, I think it's only 25 years, they've had four black head coaches. So they at least are walking the walk in terms of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so let's stick with Tampa Bay, because I think what's gone on there is really interesting. In late March, Tampa Bay head coach Bruce Arians stepped down and named his defensive coordinator Todd Bowles as head coach. And in his statement, Arians said, quote, "I wanted to ensure when I walked away that Todd Bowles would have the best opportunity to succeed. So many head coaches come into situations where they're set up for failure." He could have said black coaches specifically. He did not. And I don't want that for Todd. So we have been saying, I have been hearing that in order for change to happen, white people have to step up and make change. Scott, is that what we're seeing here?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, it's clear that when you look at Bruce Arians' track record, that he's been about bringing in black coaches and promoting them and has had his confidence in them. And so, yeah, I think he gave us the language. He said, you know, like you said, it could have been parenthetically black coaches, or he could have just said it explicitly. He knew what he was saying. He did it in a time period. You know, Shalisha said, you know, do they have the clout? Clearly, Bruce Arians did, because when Tony Dungy asked for the same thing, it was still a question. It wasn't just Tony Dungy says that we're going this way with Caldwell, and so we have Caldwell. It was still, let's go through the process. Let's kind of talk about it. Let's be make sure we're comfortable. Is he the right kind of black head coach? Like, all of that had to happen. Here, Bruce Arians seemingly came straight out and said, hey, I'm doing this, and I'm making the decision that he's the head coach. And that just spells very different, you know, kind of status and respect and, you know, where he is. It was a model of what should be done, right? I had been wondering for a long time, why are white coaches silent? Like, it just didn't make sense. Because, and I start with just the whole pipeline issue. For any coach, particularly if you were a college coach, so let's go to an Urban Meyer, let's go to anybody else, let's go to Saban. How in the world can you recruit the best athletes, have all of these black players, and then say, yeah, there just aren't enough qualified people. So then tell me what that means you think of your athletes. If ultimately you can't see in them that they have the qualifications to know the game, you don't, I mean, it's speaking about your feelings of whether or not they actually know the game. And it speaks to the idea of, can they lead? Can they even grow? Like, even if you thought, well, you know, they were young and immature, you can't imagine them growing into this. So I've had questions for a while, just I don't understand how we don't hear from coaches to just immediately refute that the person I spent all this energy recruiting, who I believed in would help me get to national championships, I don't also think that they could lead football teams in any ways. And I was happy to hear one coach come out with a firm statement. For me, that's the issue that I have with Belichick, even though I don't know enough, is I just went, so you messed around and sent the wrong text. That also tells me you weren't sending, I imagine, supportive texts to Brian Flores, and you weren't out there busting your butt to make sure your guy, right, gets the opportunity. Now, you didn't really make him a defensive coordinator, so maybe I shouldn't be surprised, right? But those are the kinds of things that when we talk about allyship, sponsorship, what is really going on? And I look at Bruce Arians and say, well, clearly he walks the talk across the board. Not only was he bringing them in, but he said, I will give up my position because I think this is what's best for the organization, and it puts him in the best position to succeed. And he identified, you got to have a quarterback. You need to have, right? He identified the thing. So he literally did listen to the research. Like, he had been well informed on these things, so it wasn't just a feeling. And I hope that other coaches, you know, take heed to that, right? That this is something that other coaches step up and realize across the board.
I want to pick up on something you said about Bill Belichick, because it feels like we've given Mike Tomlin a lot of crap for only now hiring a black coordinator. But if we look at Belichick's record, like from top to bottom, it's pretty terrible. Shalice, you've spent a lot of time with that franchise. Tell me, what's going on and why do we not hold him accountable?
I think he's not held accountable because, specific to Belichick, there have been a lot of other things that sports media writ large, the NFL media writ large criticized him for, you know, Deflategate, Spygate, those sorts of things. So people want to just tag him as a cheater, and they're not focusing on the other things. Scott's right. Brian Flores did not have the official title of defensive coordinator his last season with the Patriots. His last season with the Patriots, they won the Super Bowl. They held the Los Angeles Rams to only 3 points in the Super Bowl on the strength of Brian Flores's defensive game plan. When he was not, he was the de facto defensive coordinator and he was the play caller, but he was not the actual named defensive coordinator. It's actually still happening now because reports out of, you know, Patriots media is that Gerard Mayo, who is the black coach, who's one of the linebackers coaches and a former player and a team captain in New England for several years, he's the one who in the classrooms on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday is coming up with the plays and installing the game plan. But yet on Sundays, it's Bill Belichick's son who's wearing the headset and calling the plays. He does need to be called out for it. I think it's inexcusable. I think especially, you know, I would love to write like an open letter to Gerard Mayo and be like, you have to get out of there because if you want to be a head coach, Bill Belichick is never going to take the headset away from his own kid. It's just not going to happen. You know, Bill Belichick talks a good game about merit and I don't see favoritism. Both of his sons are on his coaching staff, right? He's getting up there. At some point, he's going to have to retire. Does he want to hand it over to one of his two sons? Possibly. I don't know. Hopefully Robert Kraft doesn't allow him to do that. But, you know, this is the kind of pernicious thing that we're talking about. And it's not just allyship. You know, for me, and I heard Dr. Yaba Blay, Scott probably knows her work anyway. I heard Dr. Yaba Blay say recently accomplice, and it has changed my entire thinking, right? Allies are people that if I email you, Karen, and say, hey, I'm going to do this. And you say, okay, let me know if you need help. But then if I email you and you say, all right, let's go. When are we going? I'll pack a bag. We go. That's an accomplice. Right. Mm-hmm. What came out recently, two more men joined the lawsuit with Brian Flores, Ray Horton and Steve Wilks.
Yeah.
And in the new lawsuit, in the refiled lawsuit, is an almost 2-year-old quote from Mike Mularkey, a white coach, on this teeny tiny podcast for Steelers fans, where he was asked a completely open-ended question about what regrets do you have in your coaching career? And Mike Mularkey brought up the fact that when he was hired as Tennessee Titans head coach in, I believe it was 2016, he was told by the owner that he was going to be head coach. We just can't say anything until we go through the Rooney Rule stuff. And Ray Horton was one of the coaches, black coaches, who was interviewed to fulfill the Rooney Rule. And, you know, Mike Mularkey said all the while I felt terrible because I knew the work that these men were putting in to get prepared for this interview, to go through this. And the whole time I knew that it was a sham process. And Mike Mularkey has been contacted by reporters and he has not backed down from those words. That's accomplice behavior.
And that's exactly right. I mean, you know, allyship, sponsorship and accomplice, we say you have to be willing to get dirty. Mm-hmm. Right, so yeah, pack a bag and be willing to stand up when they say it. Don't just pack a bag and show up and be behind the scenes. You need to be out front getting dirty with us. That way you go down when we go down, then that's a real accomplice, right? Like,
right.
And that really is, you know, that is different.
And Mike Mularkey has retired from coaching, but it was only, I think, 2 years ago. So he probably still has many friends and people that he talks to through all levels of the NFL. And a fair number of them are probably going to turn their back on him because he said the truth. You know, when I wrote it, it's similar to the lunch counter and the Freedom Riders. The white Freedom Riders were beaten just like the black Freedom Riders were. And Mike Mularkey, you know, again, he's retired, so he's not going to potentially lose jobs, but he might lose friends or he might lose influence. Maybe he's been working as like an advisor to some people. I don't know, but I'm sure that there are a lot of people in the white power structure in the NFL who are not happy with Mike Mularkey, and he's not backing down. And if this goes to discovery and they start taking, you know, testimony and stuff like that, and he joins their side, that's accomplice behavior. But that's what we need. We need the white coaches to step forward and say, this is wrong. The one thing from this past hiring cycle that sticks with me it was just, and I don't, there's so many issues because the largely white media should pick up on this, or some of them anyway, but the Minnesota Vikings went through their hiring process and they had Patrick Graham, who's a Black man. He most recently, last season, was the defensive coordinator for the New York Giants, excuse me. The media is tweeting about, oh, Patrick Graham spent 9 hours with the Minnesota Vikings, 9 hours going through the interview. No sooner did Patrick Graham walk out the doors of the Vikings facility after spending 9 hours in the interview, plus who knows how many hours preparing for that interview, do we see tweets about, oh, the Vikings are bringing in Jim Harbaugh tomorrow. He's expected to get the job. How insulting. And this is exactly what Brian Flores' lawsuit was all about. You had this 9 hours.
Yeah.
That's a full shift in a job. You spent 9 hours with this man under the guise that you were giving him a legitimate interview to be the head coach of your football team. And no sooner was he in the town car to be brought back to the airport, do you have white media saying, oh, they're bringing in Jim Harbaugh tomorrow. He's probably going to get the job. He ultimately didn't. They hired a different white coach who is way younger and way more inexperienced than Patrick Graham. But that's how it is in the NFL. I mean, that's one of the other things that's so frustrating. I brought up earlier the experience factor. Patrick Graham is Yale educated.
Right.
Played football himself, came up through the New England Patriots ranks, left because, as we just discussed, he probably wasn't going to get to be defensive coordinator as a Black man under Bill Belichick, became defensive coordinator elsewhere. And here he gets an opportunity to interview. And the Minnesota Vikings, because it fell through with Jim Harbaugh, hired Kevin O'Connell, who played underneath Tom Brady after Tom Brady had already been in the NFL for 10 years. He's like 37 years old. He doesn't call plays, which is the thing that people say Eric Bieniemy with the Chiefs doesn't do. And that's the thing that they keep saying, well, that's why Eric Bieniemy doesn't get to be a head coach. He doesn't call plays. Kevin O'Connell doesn't call plays. The offensive coordinator of the Rams before him, who is now a head coach, never called plays. It's just the goalposts are always, always, always changing. And you're fine to have a young, hotshot white coach because he breathes the same air as Sean McVay of the Rams, as opposed to giving an established, knowledgeable, experienced, you know, it's like Scott says, so many of these teams, they will draft. When I covered the New England Patriots, almost every single draft pick they would have every year had served as a team captain at his college. So you want somebody who is thought so highly of and so well respected and has such great leadership qualities that he is one of four or five captains on a 90 to 100 man roster in college, but you then don't believe they can be a coordinator for you? That they can't, you know, have the actual title of leading a room of 40, you know, 35 to 40 defensive players or whatever the case may be? It's just, it's inexcusable. And all it points back to is deliberate exclusion.
When you all talked about this in January, the landscape was pretty bleak. At that point, Mike Tomlin was the only Black head coach in the league. A number of hires have taken place since then. And if you listen to the party line coming out of the NFL, the landscape is looking better. There are now 6 head coaches of color in the league, 3 or 4 of whom are African-American. As Shalise has mentioned, Mike McDaniel does not identify as Black. Scott, as you look at the landscape now, what do you see? Has there been an improvement or are we still really far behind?
I don't see an improvement. I feel like, you know, it's, I was reading something that said, you know, Commissioner Goodell gets all of this flack, but he doesn't. He works for the owners, not the other way around. And he has no real influence. It seems obvious. He has no real influence over what happens at the individual club level. And so I don't see it as improvement. Whether you have Black GMs, if they're not allowed to hire, if they're told explicit things like malarkey, or it's implicit, right? You can feel it. You can kind of know, right? You can judge, well, hey, if I make a decision like this, it's going to mean I'm under more pressure. You're always under pressure if you're a coach of color, right? So unless they're not quite sure, right? That's the whole thing with the McDaniel piece. He was nowhere in the landscape, even on the roster of coaches of color. So I sometimes wonder, did everyone know? Like, I understand that mm-hmm. some knew, but it almost seemed like until the Niners went and said, hey, give me my draft picks, that then it was like, oh, yeah, I didn't know we could have picked him. Like, who knows? He might have had other job opportunities if they had all known that here he was. But yeah, so I see it as much the same. You know, for us, in the midst of all that had happened, for you to end up with three, our numbers are still terrible. I don't believe that there's really any impetus for them to continue to change. Many folks felt like this was just a big slap in the face, that in the midst of what you thought we should be doing, we just deliberately went against that and we don't care. And I find that to be, tough to swallow, but I think it is where we are. There's going to need to be some real changes, and I don't know how. I mean, that's the concept. We always say there's going to need to be real change. Well, who does? The owners are not going to do it. They're not going to police themselves that way. So I don't see much room for change.
As usual, they've changed the Rooney Rule. I don't know if any of those changes are actually helpful.
No, I have no hope at all. And that's, I feel terrible. I was fortunate to be part of a symposium last month. Mike Loxley, who's the head coach at the University of Maryland, has a foundation called the Coalition of Minority Football Coaches. And they had, spurred by the Brian Flores lawsuit, they had a symposium last month and trying to talk through what are the solutions. And I didn't say it publicly, but behind, I was talking to people one-on-one. I was like, I have to say, I have no optimism that this is going to change. And it's specific to me. It's become very clear that it's specific anti-Black. It's Black exclusion. We're seeing now, like, there was, you mentioned the Rooney Rule and some of the changes. Roger Goodell announced at the NFL owners meetings a few weeks ago that he is forcing teams, because as we've seen, I believe 75% of the new head coaches who are hired over the last five or six hiring cycles have all come from the offensive side of the ball. Of course, as we sit here right now, only four of the 32 teams in the NFL have Black offensive coordinators. But Roger Goodell said that every team must hire a low-level offensive assistant who is a minority or a woman. And the money is going to come from the NFL. The teams don't have to pay for it. This is something that he is mandating. Well, look at the wording of that.
Yeah.
It's a person of color or woman. The data, as Scott can, I hope, back me up on this, the data shows that affirmative action policies largely benefit white women.
Right.
So while it's lovely, and as a woman, it puts me in a little bit of a funny place, because I would love to see a woman be an offensive coordinator in the NFL someday. That would be amazing. But when you have such an umbrella rule, you're not addressing the specific anti-Black bias that there clearly is in the NFL. And I also think that new rule, because the NFL is paying for it and not the individual teams, I think it is because of what you just mentioned, that Roger Goodell, for those who may or may not know, his father was a senator from the state of New York, Republican senator, who ended up losing his job because he came out against the Vietnam War. And so for years, people have ascribed that moral goodness that Charles Goodell had to his son, Roger. And I think because people like me and other people have just hammered Roger Goodell, I think this is a small way of him to try to cover his butt and be like, well, I tried to do something to fix this. And that if you have these low level offensive assistants, ostensibly some of them will be promoted. Whether or not that actually happens is a different circumstance. But, I think he's doing it sort of as a cover his butt sort of thing, and to protect his legacy, in addition to, potentially helping more minorities and women get into the quote unquote pipeline. That pipeline thing is crap.
Shalise, I got a question for you. So when we, as we know, the beneficiaries of affirmative action, could you see a woman of color being moved into a head coaching role eventually?
Oh my God, not in my lifetime. I'll be 45 in a couple months. I don't see it ever. There's only one Black female assistant that I know of. Her name's Jennifer King. She's the assistant running backs coach in Washington. There are more female assistants than there obviously have ever been at this point. Something else we could thank Bruce Arians for. He hired the very first female assistant coach. He had two on his staff when he retired. But of all the women assistants, we haven't even seen, for all of the women that we have seen enter the coaching ranks, none of them has been a full position coach yet. They're all assistant position coaches. Which is great, but having covered an NFL team for a decade, I've seen white male coaches go from assistant position coach to position coach in a year, two tops. So, you know, we just have yet to see Jennifer King. I think this is her third season coming up in Washington. She has not yet been made just full running backs coach. Lori Lowe, who's the Locus, I think is her last name, but she's the assistant defensive line coach in Tampa Bay. She now has three or four seasons under her belt, has not yet been made just full defensive line coach. Again, we can even bring nepotism into this. Gary Kubiak was the offensive coordinator of Minnesota a couple of years ago. He decided to retire. And who became offensive coordinator? His son, who had never really been an offensive, who had only been a coach for a few years. You know, it's just heartbreaking. At the end of the day, for me, it's heartbreaking when you, if you ever get the chance to speak to an older Black coach or, you know, scout personnel person, it's just heartbreaking, you know, because they have put in so much time and so much effort. And well, what if I do this? Well, what if I do that? I think it was Ray Horton. He had cornrows. Well, he had to cut his hair, you know, because can't have a Black man with braids patrolling the sidelines as your head coach. And what did it get him? It got him a sham interview with the Tennessee Titans, who had no intention of hiring him because they wanted to hire Mike Mularkey. It's just, at the end of the day, for me, it's all just heartbreaking because it just seems like it doesn't matter that they've now settled into a thing where every year there's going to be one Black coach who gets hired. And it's like the last team, the team that drags its feet. It's like, well, nobody else hired a Black guy. So guess who gets the short straw? That's you. If you had hired somebody faster, you could have hired the white guy, but you waited too long. So now we're going to make you hire a Black guy. Like Levy Smith is even on the record as saying, I had no idea I was being considered for head coach of the Houston Texans, but they waited too long. They were too scared to pull the trigger on Josh McCown. Brian Flores filed his lawsuit. And now Lovie Smith gets to be a head coach again. The only positive is at least head coaching money is guaranteed in the NFL. So they did David Culley dirty, but he got a $22 million golden parachute. He can set his family up for the next couple of generations if he, you know, invests it wisely. So at least, you know, a couple of generations of Black families got a leg up from the Houston Texans. But that's it.
All right. Well, that's a really sort of sad note to end on, but I think
I apologize, but it's the truth.
It's where we are. Yahoo Sports, Shalice Manzi-Young. Thanks, Shalice.
You bet.
And Scott Brooks, Director of Research for the Global Sport Institute. Thanks, Scott.
Pleasure. Thank you.
This episode was produced by Karen Given. Be sure to subscribe to the Global Sport Matters podcast wherever you listen to get notified of new episodes out each week. Global Sport Matters podcast is a production of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Our digital communications specialist is Brendan Clean. Our manager of strategic initiatives is me, Kendall Jones. And our marketing and event assistants are Luke Padway, Kate Nelson, and Aiden Corrales. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at Global Sport MTRS.